He had instantly to duck to avoid a great eagle swooping out of the vast space at him. It was another eagle, a different eagle. The next one was a different eagle too, and the next. The air seemed to be thick with eagles, and it was obviously impossible to enter Valhalla without getting swooped on by at least half a dozen of them. Even eagles were being swooped on by eagles. Dirk threw up his arms over his head to fend off the wild, beating furies, turned, tripped, and fell down behind a huge table onto a floor of heavy, damp, earthy straw. His hat rolled under the table. He scrambled after it, stuffed it back firmly on his head, and slowly peered up over the table. The hall was dark, but alive with great bonfires. Noise and wood smoke filled the air, and the smells of roasting pigs, roasting sheep, roasting boar, and sweat, and reeking wine, and singed eagle wings. The table he was crouched behind was one of countless slabs of oak on trestles that stretched in every direction, laden with steaming hunks of dead animals, huge breads, great iron beakers slopping with wine, and candles like wax anthills. Massive, sweaty figures seethed around them, on them, eating, drinking, fighting over the food, fighting in the food, fighting with the food. A yard or so from Dirk, a warrior was standing on top of a table fighting a pig, which had been roasting for 6 hours, and he was clearly losing, but losing with vim and spirit, and being cheered on by other warriors who were dousing him down with wine from a trough. The roof, as much of it as could be made out at this distance, and by the dark and flickering light of the bonfires, was made of lashed-together shields. Dirk clutched his hat, kept his head down, and ran, trying to make his way towards the side of the hall. As he ran, feeling himself to be virtually invisible by reason of being completely sober, and by his own lights normally dressed, he seemed to pass examples of every form of bodily function imaginable, other than actual teeth-cleaning. The smell, like that of the tramp in King's Cross Station, who must surely be here participating, was one that never stopped coming at you. It grew and grew until it seemed that your head had to become bigger and bigger to accommodate it. The din of sword on sword, sword on shield, sword on flesh, flesh on flesh, was one that made the eardrums reel and quiver and want to cry. He was pummeled, tripped, elbowed, shoved, and drenched with wine as he scurried and pushed through the wild throng, but arrived at last at a side wall, massive slabs of wood and stone, faced with sheets of stinking cowhide. Panting, he stopped for a moment, looked back, and surveyed the scene with amazement. It was Valhalla. Of that, there could be absolutely no question. This was not something that could be mocked up by a catering company, and the whole seething, wild mass of carousing gods and warriors and their caroused-at ladies, with their shields and fires and boars, did seem to fill a space that must be something approaching the size of St. Pancras Station. The sheer heat that rose off it all seemed as if it should suffocate the flocks of deranged eagles which thrashed through the air above them. And maybe it was. He was by no means certain that a flock of enraged eagles which thought they might be suffocating would behave significantly differently from many of the eagles he was currently watching. There was something he had been putting off wondering while he had fought his way through the mass, but the time had come to wonder it now. What, he wondered, about the Draycotts? What could the Draycotts possibly be doing here? And where in such a melee could the Draycotts possibly be? He narrowed his eyes and peered into the heaving throng, trying to see if he could locate anywhere a pair of red designer spectacles or a quiet Italian suit, mingling out there with the clanging breastplates and the sweaty leathers, knowing that the attempt was futile, but feeling that it should be made. No, he decided he couldn't see them. Not, he felt, their kind of party. Further reflections along these lines were cut short by a heavy short-handled axe which hurtled through the air and buried itself with an astounding thud in the wall about 3 inches from his left ear, and for a moment blotted out all thought. When he recovered from the shock of it, and let his breath out, he thought that it was probably not something that had been thrown at him with malicious intent, but was merely warriorly high spirits. Nevertheless, he was not in a partying mood, and decided to move on. He edged his way along the wall in the direction which, had this actually been St. Pancras Station rather than the Hall of Valhalla, would have led to the ticket office. He didn't know what he would find there, but he reckoned that it must be different to this, which would be good. It seemed to him that things were generally quieter here, out on the periphery. The biggest and best of the good times seemed to be concentrated more strongly towards the middle of the hall, whereas the tables he was passing now seemed to be peopled with those who looked as if they'd reached that season in their immortal lives when they preferred to contemplate the times when they used to wrestle dead pigs, or to pass appreciative comments to each other about the finer points of dead pig wrestling technique, than actually to wrestle with one again themselves just at the moment. He overheard one remark to his companion that it was the left-handed three-fingered flat grip on the opponent's sternum that was all-important at the crucial moment of finally not quite falling over in a complete stupor. to which his companion responded with a benign, "Oah." Dirk stopped, looked, and backtracked. Sitting hunched in a thoughtful posture over his iron plate, and clad in heavily stained and matted furs and buckles, which were, if anything, more rank and stinking than the ensemble Dirk had last encountered him in, was Dirk's companion from the concourse at King's Cross Station. Dirk wondered how to approach him. A quick backslap and a, "Hey, good party, lots of energy," was one strategy, but Dirk didn't think it was the right one. While he was wondering, an eagle suddenly swooped down from out of the air, and with a lot of beating and thrashing, landed on the table in front of the old man, folded its wings, and advanced on him, demanding to be fed. Easily, the old man pulled a bit of meat off a bone, and held it up to the great bird, which pecked it sharply but accurately out of his fingers. Dirk thought that this was the key to a friendly approach. He leant over the table, and picked up a small hunk of meat, and offered it in turn to the bird. The bird attacked him and went for his neck, forcing him to try and beat the savage creature off with his hat, but the introduction was made. "Oah," said the man, chewed the eagle away and shifted a couple of inches along the bench. Though it was not a fulsome invitation, it was at least an invitation. Dirk clambered over the bench and sat down. "Thank you," said Dirk, puffing. "Oah, if you remember, we—" At that moment, the most tremendous reverberating thump sounded out across Valhalla. It was the sound of a drum being beaten, but it sounded like a drum of immense proportions, as it had to be to make itself heard over the tumult of noise with which the hall was filled. The drum sounded three times in slow and massive beats, like the heartbeat of the hall itself. Dirk looked up to see where the sound might have come from. He noticed for the first time that at the south end of the hall, to which he had been heading, a great balcony or bridge extended across most of its width. There were some figures up there, dimly visible through the heat haze and the eagles, but Dirk had a sense that whoever was up there presided over whoever was down here. Odin, thought Dirk. Odin the Allfather must be up on the balcony. The sound of the revels died down quickly, though it was several seconds before the reverberations of the noise finally fell away. When all was quiet but expectant, a great voice rang out from the balcony and through the hall. The voice said, "The time of the challenging hour is nearly at an end. The challenging hour has been called by the great god Thor, for the third time of asking, where is Thor?" A murmuring throughout the hall suggested that nobody knew where Thor was, and why he had not come to make his challenge. The voice said, "This is a very grave affront to the dignity of the Allfather. If there is no challenge before the expiration of the hour, the penalty for Thor must be correspondingly grave." The drum beat again three times, and the consternation in the hall increased. Where was Thor? "He's with some girl," said a voice above the rest, and there were loud shouts of laughter, and a return to the hubbub of before. "Yes," said Dirk quietly, "I expect he probably is." "Oah?" Dirk had supposed that he was talking to himself, and was surprised to have elicited a response from the man, though not particularly surprised at the response that had been elicited. "Thor called this meeting tonight?" Dirk asked him. "Oah. Bit rude not to turn up." "Oah. I expect everyone's a bit upset." "Not as long as there's enough pigs to go around." "Pigs?" "Oah." Dirk didn't immediately know how to go on from here. "Oah," he said, resignedly. "It's only Thor as really cares, you see," said the old man. "Keeps on issuing his challenge, then not being able to prove it. Can't argue. Gets all confused and angry, does something stupid, can't sort it out, and gets made to do a penance. Everybody else just turns up for the pigs." "Oah?" Dirk was learning a whole new conversational technique, and was astounded at how successful it was. He regarded the man with a newfound respect. "Do you know how many stones there are in Wales?" asked the old man suddenly. "Oah?" said Dirk warily. He didn't know this joke. "Nor do I. He wouldn't tell anybody. Says count 'em yourself, and goes off in a sulk." "Oah?" He didn't think it was a very good one. "So this time he hasn't even turned up. Can't say I blame him. But I'm sorry, because I think he might be right." "Oah?" The man lapsed into silence. Dirk waited. "Oah?" he said again hopefully. Nothing. Said Dirk, going for a cautious prompt, "you think he might be right, eh?" "Oah." "So, old Thor might be right, eh? That's the story," said Dirk. "Oah." In what way," said Dirk, running out of patience at last, "do you think he might be right?" "Oh, every way." "Oah," said Dirk, defeated. "It's no secret that the gods have fallen on hard times," said the old man grimly. That's clear for all to see, even for the ones who only care about the pigs, which is most of them. And when you feel you're not needed any more, it can be hard to think beyond the next pig, even if you used to have the whole world there with you. Everyone just accepts it as inevitable. Everyone except Thor, that is. And now he's given up. Hasn't even bothered to turn up and break a pig with us. Given up his challenge. Oh, ah. Oh, ah, said Dirk. Oh, ah. So, Thor's challenge, then, said Dirk, tentatively. Oh, ah. What was it? Oh, ah. Dirk lost his patience entirely and rounded on the man. What was Thor's challenge to Odin? He insisted angrily. The man looked round at him in slow surprise, looked him up and down with his big, sagging eyes. You're a mortal, aren't you? Yes, said Dirk testily. I'm a mortal. Of course I'm a mortal. What has being a mortal got to do with it? How did you get here? I followed you. He pulled the screwed-up empty cigarette packet out of his pocket and put it on the table. Thanks, he said. I owe you. It was a pretty feeble type of apology, he thought, but it was the best he could manage. Oh, ah. The man looked away. What was Thor's challenge to Odin? Said Dirk, trying hard to keep the impatience out of his voice this time. What does it matter to you? The old immortal said bitterly. You're a mortal. Why should you care? You've got what you want out of it, you and your kind. For what little it's now worth. Got what we want out of what? The deal, said the old immortal. The contract that Thor claims Odin has entered into. Contract? Said Dirk. What contract? The man's face filled with an expression of slow anger. The bonfires of Valhalla danced deeply in his eyes as he looked at Dirk. The sale, he said darkly, of an immortal soul. What? Said Dirk. He had already considered this idea and discounted it. You mean a man has sold his soul to him? What man? It doesn't make sense. No, said the man. That wouldn't make sense at all. I said an immortal soul. Thor says that Odin has sold his soul to man. Dirk stared at him with horror, and then slowly raised his eyes to the balcony. Something was happening there. The great drum beat out again, and the hall of Valhalla began to hush itself once more. But a second or third drum beat failed to come. Something unexpected seemed to have occurred, and the figures on the balcony were moving in some confusion. The challenging hour was just expiring, but a challenge of some kind seemed to have arrived. Dirk beat his palms to his forehead, and swayed where he sat as all kinds of realizations finally dawned on him. Not to man, he said, but to a man and a woman, a lawyer and an advertiser. I said it was all her fault the moment I saw her. I didn't realize I might actually be right. He rounded on his companion urgently. I have to get up there, he said. For God's sake, help me. Odin! Thor let out a bellow of rage which made the sky shake. The heavy clouds let out a suppressed grunt of thunder at the sheer volume of air that moved beneath them. Kate started back, white with fear and shock, with her ears ringing. Torag! He hurled his hammer to the ground right at his very feet with both hands. He held it this short distance with such astounding force that it hit and rebounded into the air up to 100 feet. With an immense explosion of air from his lungs, he hurled himself up into the air after it, caught it just as it was beginning to drop, and hurled it straight back down at the ground again, catching it again as it bounded back up, twisting violently round in mid-air, and hurling it with all the force he could muster out to sea, before falling to the ground himself on his back, and pounding the earth with his ankles, elbows, and fists in an incredible tattoo of rage. The hammer shot out over the sea on a very low trajectory. The head went down into the water and planed through it at a constant depth of about 6 inches. A sharp ripple opened slowly but easily across its surface, extending eventually to about a mile, as the hammer sliced its way through it like a surgeon's knife. The inner walls of the ripple deepened smoothly in its wake, falling away from the sheer force of the hammer till a vast valley had opened in the face of the sea. The walls of the water wobbled and swayed uncertainly, then folded up and crashed together in a crazed and foaming tumult. The hammer lifted its head and swung up high into the air. Thor leapt to his feet and watched it, still pounding his feet on the ground like a boxer, but like a boxer who was perhaps about to precipitate a major earthquake. When the hammer reached the top of its trajectory, Thor hurled his fist downward like a conductor, and the hammer hurtled down into the crashing mass of sea. That seemed to calm the sea for a moment, in the same way that a smack in the face will calm a hysteric. The moment passed. An immense column of water erupted up after the smack, and seconds later the hammer exploded upwards out of its centre, pulling another huge column of water up from the middle of the first one. The hammer somersaulted at the top of its rise, turned, spun, and rushed back to its owner like a wildly overexcited puppy. Thor caught at it, but instead of stopping, he allowed it to carry him backwards, and together they tumbled back through the rocks for about 100 yards and scuffled to a halt in some soft earth. Instantly, Thor was back on his feet again. He turned round and round, bounding from one leg to another with strides of nearly 10 feet, swinging the hammer round him at arm's length. When he released it again, it raced out to sea once more, but this time it tore round the surface in a giant semicircle, causing the sea to rear up around its circumference, to form for a moment a gigantic amphitheatre of water. When it fell forward, it crashed like a tidal wave, ran forward, and threw itself enraged against the short wall of the cliff. The hammer returned to Thor, who threw it off again instantly in a great overarm. It flew into a rock, hitting off a fat, angry spark. It bounded off further and hit a spark off another rock and another. Thor threw himself forward onto his knees, and with each rock the hammer hit, he pounded the ground with his fist to make the rock rise to meet the hammer. Spark after spark erupted from the rocks. The hammer hit each successive one harder and harder, until one spark provoked a warning lick of lightning from the clouds. And then the sky began to move, slowly, like a great angry animal uncoiling in its lair. The pounding sparks flew faster and heavier from the hammer. More lightning licks arced down to meet them from the sky, and the whole earth was beginning to tremble in something very like fearful excitement. Thor hauled his elbows up above his head, and then thrust them hard down with another ringing bellow at the sky.
Odin!
The sky seemed to crack open.
Torag!
Thor threw himself into the ground, heaving aside about 2 skipsful of rocky earth. He shook with expanding rage. With a deep groan, the whole of the side of the cliff began slowly to lean forward into the sea as he pushed and shook. In a few seconds more, it tumbled heavily into the seething torment beneath it as Thor clambered back, seized a rock the size of a grand piano, and held it above his head. Everything seemed still for a fleeting moment. Thor hurled the rock into the sea. He regained his hammer. He bellowed again.
Odin!
His hammer cracked down. A torrent of water erupted from the ground, and the sky exploded. Lightning flickered down like a white wall of light for miles along the coast in either direction. Thunder roared like colliding worlds, and the clouds vomited rain that shattered the ground. Thor stood exulting in the torrent. A few minutes later, and the violence abated. A strong and steady rain continued to fall. The clouds were cleansing themselves, and the weak rays of the early morning light began to find their way through the thinning cover. Thor trudged back up from where he had been standing, slapping and washing the mud from his hands. He caught at his hammer when it flew to him. He found Kate standing watching him, shivering with astonishment, fear, and fury.
"What was all that about?"
she yelled at him. "I just needed to be able to lose my temper properly," he said. When this didn't seem to satisfy her, he added, "A god can show off once in a while, can't he?" The huddled figure of Tsuliwiensis came hurrying out through the rain towards him.
"You're a noisy boy, Thor," she scolded, "a noisy boy!"
But Thor was gone. When they looked, they guessed that he must be the tiny speck hurtling northwards through the clearing sky. Cynthia Draycott peered over the balcony at the scene below them with distaste. Valhalla was back in full swing. "I hate this," she said. "I don't want this going on in my life." "You don't have to, my darling," said Clive Draycott quietly from behind her, with his hands on her shoulders. "It's all going to be taken care of right now, and it's going to work out just fine. Couldn't be better, in fact. It's just what we wanted. You know, you look fantastic in those glasses. They really suit you. I mean, really, they're very chic." "Clive, it was meant to have been taken care of originally. The whole point was that we weren't to be troubled. We could just do it, deal with it, and forget about it. That was the whole point. I've put up with enough shit in my life. I just want it to be good, 100%. I don't want all this." "Exactly. And that's why this is so perfect for us. So perfect. Clear breach of contract. We get everything we wanted now, and we're released from all obligations. Perfecto. We come out of it smelling of roses, and we have a life that is just 100% good. 100% and clean. Just exactly as you wanted it. Really, it couldn't be better for us. Trust me. Cynthia Draycott hugged herself irritably. So what about this new person? Something else we have to deal with. It'll be so easy, so easy. Listen, this is nothing. We either cut him into it or we cut him right out. It'll be taken care of before we leave here. We'll buy him something, a new coat. Maybe we'll have to buy him a new house. Know what that'll cost us? He gave a charming smile. It's nothing. You won't ever even need to think about it. You won't ever even need to think about not thinking about it. It's that easy. Okay? Okay, I'll be right back. He turned and headed back into the antechamber of the Hall of the Allfather, smiling all the way. So, Mr... He made a show of looking at the card again. Gently, you want to act for these people, do you? These immortal gods, said Dirk. Okay, gods, said Draycott. That's fine. Perhaps you'll do a better job than the manic little hustler had to deal with the first time out. You know, he's really quite a little character, our Mr. Rag. Mr. Rag. You know, that guy was really quite amazing. He did everything he could, tried every oldest trick in the book to freak me out and give me the runaround. You know how I deal with people like that? Simple. I ignore it. I just ignore it. If he wants to play around and threaten and screech and shovel in 517 subclauses that he thinks he's going to catch me out on, that's okay. He's just taking up time. But so what? I've got time. I've got plenty of time for people like Mr. Rag. Because you know what the really crazy thing is? You know what's really crazy? The guy cannot draw up an actual contract to save his life. Really, to save his life. And I tell you something, that's fine by me. He can thrash around and spit all he likes. When he gets tired, I just reel him in. Listen, I draw up contracts in the record business. These guys are just minnows by comparison. They're primitive savages. You've met them. You've dealt with them. They're primitive savages. Well, aren't they? I mean, like the Red Indians. They don't even know what they've got. You know, these people are lucky they didn't meet some real shark. I mean it. You know what America cost? You know what the whole United States of America actually cost? You don't, and neither do I. And shall I tell you why? The sum is so negligible that someone could tell us what it was, and 2 minutes later we would have forgotten. It would have gone clean out of our minds. Now, compared with that, let me tell you, I am providing. I am really providing. A private suite in the Woods Head Hospital, lavish attention, food, sensational quantities of linen. Sensational! You could practically buy the United States of America at today's prices for what that's all costing. But you know what? I said, if he wants the linen, let him have the linen. Just let him have it. It's fine. The guy's earned it. He can have all the linen he wants. Just don't fuck with me is all. Now let me tell you, this guy has a nice life. A nice life. And I think that's what we all want, isn't it? A nice life. This guy certainly did. And he didn't know how to have it. None of these guys did. They're just kind of helpless in the modern world. It's kind of tough for them, and I'm just trying to help out. Let me tell you how naive they are. And I mean naive. My wife, Cynthia, you've met her, and let me tell you, she is the best. I tell you, my relationship with Cynthia is so good, I don't want to hear about your relationship with your wife, said Dirk. Okay, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. I just think maybe it's worth you getting to know a few things. But whatever you want is fine. Okay, Cynthia's in advertising. You know that. She's a senior partner in a major agency. Major. They did some big campaign, really big. Few years back, in which some actor is playing a god in this commercial, and he's endorsing something, I don't know, a soft drink, you know, tooth rot for kids. And Odin at this time is just a down and out. He's living on the streets. He simply can't get anything together because he's just not adapted for this world. All that power, but he doesn't know how to make it work for him here, today. Now here's the crazy part. Odin sees this commercial on the television, and he thinks to himself, hey, I could do that. I'm a god. He thinks maybe he could get paid for being in a commercial. And you know what that would be? Pays even less than the United States of America costs, you follow me? Think about it. Odin, the chief and fount of all the power of all the Norse gods, thinks he might be able to get paid for being in a television commercial to sell soft drinks. And this guy, this god, literally goes out and tries to find someone who'll let him be in a television commercial. Pathetically naive. But also greedy, let's not forget greedy. Anyway, he happens to come to Cynthia's attention. She's just a lowly account executive at the time, doesn't pay any attention, thinks he's just a wacko. But then she gets kind of fascinated by how odd he is, and I get to see him. And you know what? It dawns on us, he's for real. The guy is for real. A real, actual god with the whole panoply of divine powers. And not only a god, but like the main one. The one all the others depend on for their power. And he wants to be in a commercial. Let's just say the word again, shall we? A commercial. The idea was dumbfounding. Didn't the guy know what he had? Didn't he realize what his power could get him? Apparently not. I have to tell you, this was the most astounding moment in our lives. Astounding. Let me tell you, Cynthia and I have always known that we were, well, special people, and that something special would happen to us. And here it was. Something special. But look, we're not greedy. We don't want all that power, all that wealth. And I mean, we're looking at the world here, the whole fucking world. We could own the world if we wanted to, but who wants to own the world? Think of the trouble. We don't even want huge wealth, all those lawyers and accountants to deal with, and I can tell you, I'm a lawyer. Okay, so you can hire people to look after your lawyers and accountants for you, but who are those people going to be? Just more lawyers and accountants. And you know, we don't even want the responsibility for it all. It's too much. So then, I have this idea. It's like you buy a big property and then you sell on what you don't want. That way you get what you want, and a lot of other people get what they want. Only they get it through you, and they feel a little obligated to you. And they remember who they got it through because they sign a piece of paper which says how obligated they feel to you. And money flows back to pay for our Mr. Odin's very, very, very expensive private medical care. So we don't have much, Mr. Gently. One or two modestly nice houses, one or two modestly nice cars. We have a very nice life. Very, very nice indeed. We don't need much because anything we need is always made available to us. It's taken care of. All we demanded, and it was a very reasonable demand in the circumstances, was that we didn't want to know any more about it. We take our modest requirements and we bow out. We want nothing more than absolute peace and absolute quiet and a nice life, because Cynthia's sometimes a little nervous. Okay. And then what happens this morning? Right on our own doorstep. Pow! It's disgusting. I mean, it is really a disgusting little number. And you know how it happened? Here's how it happened. It's our friend Mr. Rag again, and he's trying to be a clever, tricky little voodoo lawyer. It's so pathetic. He has fun trying to waste my time with all his little tricks and games and runarounds, and then he tries to faze me by presenting me with a bill for his time. That's nothing. It's work creation. All lawyers do it. Okay, so I say, I'll take your bill. I'll take it. I don't care what it is. You give me your bill, and I'll see it's taken care of. It's okay. So he gives it to me. It's only later I see it's got this tricky kind of subtotal thing in it. So what? He's trying to be clever. He's given me a hot potato. Listen, the record business is full of hot potatoes. You just get them taken care of. There are always people happy to take care of things for you when they want to make their way up the ladder. If they're worthy of their place on the ladder, well, they'll get it taken care of in return. You get a hot potato, you pass it on. I passed it on. Listen, there were a lot of people who were very happy to get things taken care of for me. Hey, you know, it was really funny seeing how far and how fast that particular potato got passed on. That told me a lot about who was bright and who was not. But then it lands up in my back garden, and that's a penalty clause job, I'm afraid. The Wood's Head stuff is a very expensive little number, and I think your clients may have blown it on that particular score. We have the whip hand here. We can just cancel this whole thing. Believe me, I have everything I could possibly want now. But listen, Mr. Gently, I think you understand my position. We've been pretty frank with each other, and I felt good about that. There are certain sensitivities involved, of course, and I'm also in a position to be able to make a lot of things happen. So perhaps we can come to any one of a number of possible accommodations. Anything you want, Mr. Gently, it can be made to happen. Just to see you dead, Mr. Draycott, said Dirk Gently. Just to see you dead. Well, fuck you too, said Mr. Draycott. Dirk Gently turned and left the room, and went to tell his new client that he thought they might have a problem. A little while later, a dark blue BMW pulled quietly away from the otherwise deserted forecourt of St. Pancras Station and moved off up the quiet streets. Somewhat dejected, Dirk Gently put on his hat and left his newly acquired and newly relinquished client, who said that he wished to be alone now and maybe turn into a rat or something, like some other people he could mention. He closed the great doors behind him and walked slowly out onto the balcony, overlooking the great vaulted hall of gods and heroes, Valhalla. He arrived just as the last few stragglers of the revels were fading away, presumably to emerge at the same moment in the great vaulted train shed of St. Pancras Station. He stayed staring for a while at the empty hall, in which the bonfires are now just fading embers. It then took the very slightest flicker of his head for him to perform the same transition himself, and he found himself standing in a gusty and dishevelled corridor of the empty Midland Grand Hotel. Out in the great dark concourse of St. Pancras Station, he saw again the last stragglers from Valhalla shuffling away and out into the cold streets of London to find benches that were designed not to be slept on, and to try to sleep on them. He sighed and tried to find his way out of the derelict hotel, a task that proved more difficult than he had anticipated, as immense and as dark and as labyrinthine as it was. He found at last the great winding Gothic staircase, which led all the way down to the huge arches of the entrance lobby, decorated with carvings of dragons and griffins and heavy ornamental ironwork. The main front entrance was locked, as it had been for years, and eventually Dirk found his way down a side corridor to an exit manned by a great sweaty splodge of a man who guarded it at night. He demanded to know how Dirk had gained entrance to the hotel, and refused to be satisfied by any of his explanations. In the end, he had simply to allow Dirk to leave, since there was little else he could do. Dirk crossed from this entrance to the entrance into the station booking hall, and then into the station itself. For a while he simply stood there, looking around, and then he left via the main station entrance, and descended the steps which led down onto the St. Pancras Road. As he emerged onto the street, he was so surprised not to be instantly swooped upon by a passing eagle, that he tripped and stumbled, and was run over by the first of the early morning's motorcycle couriers. With a huge crash, Thor surged through the wall at the far end of the Great Hall of Valhalla, and stood ready to proclaim to the assembled gods and heroes that he had finally managed to break through to Norway, and had found a copy of the contract Odin had signed, buried deep in the side of a mountain. But he couldn't, because they'd all gone, and there was no one there. "There's no one here," he said to Kate, releasing her from his huge grip. "They've all gone." He slumped in disappointment. "Well," said Kate, "we'll try the old man's chambers," said Thor, and hurled his hammer up to the balcony, with themselves in tow. He stalked through the great chambers, ignoring Kate's pleas, protests, and general abuse. He wasn't there. "He's here somewhere," said Thor angrily, trailing his hammer behind him. "We'll go through the world divide," he said, and took hold of Kate again. They flicked themselves through. They were in a large bedroom suite in the hotel. Litter and scraps of rotting carpet covered the floors. The windows were grimy with years of neglect, pigeon droppings were everywhere, and the peeling paintwork made it look as if several small families of starfish had exploded on the walls. There was an abandoned trolley bed in the middle of the floor, in which an old man lay in beautifully laundered linen, weeping from his one remaining eye. "I found the contract, you bastard!" raged Thor, waving at him. "I found the deal you did. You sold all our power to a lawyer and an advertiser and all sorts of other people. You stole our power. You couldn't steal all of mine because I'm too strong, and you kept me bewildered and confused and made bad things happen every time I got angry. You prevented me getting back home to Norway by every method you could because you knew I'd find this. You and that poison dwarf Torag. You'd been abusing and humiliating me for years and..."
"Yes, yes, we know all that," said Odin.
"Well, good."
"Thor," said Kate.
"Well, I've shaken all that off now," shouted Thor.
"Yes, I see.
I went somewhere I could get good and angry in peace, when I knew you'd be otherwise occupied and expecting me to be here, and I had a hell of a good shout and blew things up a bit, and I'm all right now, and I'm going to tear this up for a start." He ripped right through the contract, threw the pieces in the air, and incinerated them with a look.
"Thor," said Kate.
"And I'm going to put right all the things you made happen so I'd be afraid of getting angry. The poor girl at the airline check-in desk that got turned into a drink machine. Woof, wham, she's back. The jet fighter that tried to shoot me down when I was flying to Norway. Woof, wham, it's back. See? I'm back in control of myself."
"What jet fighter?" asked Kate.
"You haven't told me about a jet fighter. It tried to shoot me down over the North Sea. We had a scrap, and in the heat of the moment I turned it into an eagle, and it's been bothering me ever since. So now that's dealt with. Don't look at me like that. I did what I could. I took care of his wife by fixing one of those lottery things. Look," he added angrily, "all this has been very difficult for me, you know. All right, what else?"
"My table lamp," said Kate quietly.
"And Kate's table lamp. It shall be a small kitten no more. Woof, wham. Thor speaks, and it is so. What was that noise?"
A ruddy glow was spreading across the London skyline. "Thor, I think there's something wrong with your father."
"I should bloody well hope so. Oh, what's wrong? Father, are you all right?"
"I have been so very, very foolish and unwise," wept Odin. "I've been so wicked and evil and..."
"Yes, well, that's what I think too," said Thor, and sat on the end of his bed. "So, what are we going to do?"
"I don't think I could live without my linen and my sister Bailey, and it's been so, so long, and I'm so, so old. Torag said I should kill you, but I would rather have killed myself. Oh, Thor, Oh, said Thor, I see. Well, I don't know what to do now. Blast. Blast everything.
Thor?
Yes, yes, what is it?
Thor, it's very simple what you do about your father and the wood's head, said Kate.
Oh, yes? What then?
I'll tell you on one condition.
Oh, really? And what's that?
That you tell me how many stones there are in Wales.
What? Exclaimed Thor in outrage. Away from me! That's years of my life you're talking about.
Kate shrugged.
No, said Thor. Anything but that. Anyway, he added sullenly, I told you.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did. I said I lost count somewhere in Mid-Glamorgan. Well, I was hardly going to start again, was I? Think, girl, think.
Beating a path through the difficult territory to the northeast of Valhalla, a network of paths that seemed to lead only to other paths and then back to the first paths again for another try, went two figures. One, a big, stupid, violent creature with green eyes and a scythe which hung from its belt and often seriously impeded its progress. The other, a small, crazed creature who clung on to the back of the bigger one, manically urging him on while actually impeding his progress still further. They attained at last a long, low, smelly building, into which they hurried, shouting for horses. The old stable-master came forward, recognized them, and having heard already of their disgrace, was at first disinclined to help them on their way. The scythe flashed through the air, and the stable-master's head started upwards in surprise, while his body took an affronted step backwards, swayed uncertainly, and then, for lack of any further instructions to the contrary, keeled over backwards in its own time. His head bounded into the hay. His assailants hurriedly lashed up two horses to a cart and clattered away out of the stable-yard and along the broader thoroughfare which led upwards to the north. They made rapid progress up the road for a mile, Tow-Rag urging the horses on frantically with a long and cruel whip. After a few minutes, however, the horses began to slow down and to look about them uneasily. Tow-Rag lashed them all the harder, but they became more anxious still, then suddenly lost all control and reared in terror, turning over the cart and tipping its occupants out onto the road, from which they instantly sprang up in a rage. Tow-Rag screamed at the terrified horses, and then, out of the corner of his eye, caught sight of what had so disturbed them. It wasn't so terrifying. It was just a large, white, metal box, upturned on a pile of rubbish by the roadside, and rattling itself. The horses were rearing and trying to bolt away from the big, white, rattling thing, but they were impossibly entangled in their traces. They were only working themselves up into a thrashing lather of panic. Tow-Rag quickly realized that there would be no calming them until the box was dealt with.
"Whatever it is," he screeched at the green-eyed creature. "Kill it!"
Green-Eye unhooked his scythe from his belt once more, and clambered up the pile of rubbish to where the box was rattling. He kicked it, and it only rattled the more. He got his foot behind it, and with a heavy thrust, shoved it away down the heap. The big white box slithered a foot or so, then turned over and toppled to the ground. It rested there for a moment, and then a door, finally freed, flew open. The horses screamed in fear. Tow-Rag and his green-eyed thug approached the thing with worried curiosity, then staggered back in horror as a great and powerful new god erupted from its innards. The following afternoon, at a comfortable distance from all these events, set at a comfortable distance from a well-proportioned window, through which the afternoon light was streaming, lay an elderly, one-eyed man in a white bed. A newspaper sat like a half-collapsed tent on the floor, where it had been hurled 2 minutes before. The man was awake, but not glad to be. His exquisitely frail hands lay slightly curled on the pure white linen sheets, and quivered very faintly. His name was variously given as Mr. Odwin, or Wodin, or Odin. He was, is, a god, and furthermore he was a confused and startled god. He was confused and startled because of the report he had just been reading on the front page of the newspaper, which was that another god had been cutting loose and making a nuisance of himself. It didn't say so in so many words, of course. It merely described what had happened last night, when a missing jet fighter aircraft had mysteriously erupted under full power from out of a house in North London, into which it could not conceivably have been thought to have fitted. It had instantly lost its wings and gone into a screaming dive and crashed and exploded in a main road. The pilot had managed to eject during the few seconds he had had in the air, and had landed, shaken, bruised, but otherwise unharmed, and babbling about strange men with hammers flying over the North Sea. Luckily, because of the time at which the inexplicable disaster had occurred, the roads were almost deserted, and apart from massive damage to property, the only fatalities to have occurred were the as yet unidentified occupants of a car, which was thought to have been possibly a BMW and possibly blue, though because of the rather extreme nature of the accident, it was rather hard to tell.
He was very, very tired, and did not want to think about it. Did not want to think about last night. Did not want to think of anything other than linen sheets, and how wonderful it was when Sister Bailey patted them down around him, as she had just now, just 5 minutes ago, and again, just 10 minutes before that. The American girl, Kate something, came into his room. He wished she would just let him sleep. She was going on about something being all fixed up. She congratulated him on having extremely high blood pressure, high cholesterol levels, and a very dicky heart, as a consequence of which the hospital would be very glad to accept him as a lifelong patient in return for his entire estate. They didn't even care to know what his estate was worth, because it would clearly be sufficient to cover a stay as brief as his was likely to be. She seemed to expect him to be pleased, so he nodded amiably, thanked her vaguely, and drifted happily off to sleep. The same afternoon, Dirk gently awoke, also in hospital, suffering from mild concussion, scrapes and bruises, and a broken leg. He had had the greatest difficulty in explaining, on admittance, that most of his injuries had been caused by a small boy and an eagle, and that really being run over by a motorcycle courier was a relatively restful experience, since it mostly involved lying down a lot and not being swooped on every 2 minutes. He was kept under sedation, in other words, he slept, for most of the morning, suffering terrible dreams in which Torag and a green-eyed, scythe-bearing giant made their escape to the northeast from Valhalla, where they were unexpectedly accosted and consumed by a newly created immense guilt god, which had finally escaped from what looked suspiciously like an upturned refrigerator on a skip. He was relieved to be woken at last from this by a cheery, "Oh, it's you, is it? You nicked my book." He opened his eyes and was greeted by the sight of Sally Mills, the girl he had been violently accosted by the previous day in the cafe, for no better reason than that he had, prior to nicking her book, nicked her coffee. "Well, I'm glad to see you took my advice and came in to have your nose properly attended to," she said, as she fussed around him. "Pretty roundabout way you seem to have taken, but you're here, and that's the main thing. You caught up with the girl you were interested in, did you? Oddly enough, you're on the very bed that she was in. If you see her again, perhaps you could give her this pizza which she arranged to have delivered before checking herself out. It's all cold now, but the courier did insist that she was very adamant it should be delivered. I don't mind you nicking the book, really, though. I don't know why I buy them, really. They're not very good. Only everyone always does, don't they? Someone told me there's a rumour he entered into a pact with the devil or something. I think that's nonsense. Though I did hear another story about him which I much preferred. Apparently he's always having these mysterious deliveries of chickens to his hotel rooms, and no one dares to ask why or even guess what it is he wants them for, because nobody ever sees a single scrap of them again. Well, I met somebody who knows exactly what he wants them for. The somebody I met once had the job of secretly smuggling the chickens straight back out of his rooms again. What Howard Bell gets out of it is a reputation for being a very strange and demonic man, and everybody buys his books. Nice work if you can get it, is what I say. Anyway, I expect you don't want to have me nattering at you all afternoon, and even if you do, I've got better things to do. Sister says you'll probably be discharged this evening, so you can go to your own home and sleep in your own bed, which I'm sure you'll much prefer. Anyway, I hope you feel better. Here's a couple of newspapers. Dirk took the papers, glad to be left alone at last. He first turned to see what the great Zaganza had to say about his day. The great Zaganza said, "You are very fat and stupid, and persistently wear a ridiculous hat, which you should be ashamed of." He grunted slightly to himself about this, and turned to the horoscope in the other paper. It said, "Today is a day to enjoy home comforts." Yes, he thought. He would be glad to get back home. He was still strangely relieved about getting rid of his old fridge, and looked forward to enjoying a new phase of fridge ownership, with the spanking new model currently sitting in his kitchen at home. There was the eagle to think about, but he would worry about that later, when he got home. He turned to the front page to see if there was any interesting news.